the interest of Roosevelt, of Churchill, was that the counter-invasion of Europe, when ready, should come from the Mediterranean, should come from the underbelly of Europe, so that the Western allies, the United States and Britain, would be present in Eastern Europe to halt Russian post-war colonialization of Eastern Europe. This is the picture in 1944. This is Europe in 1944. Bordering the conquered territories is the yellow of the Nazi German homeland. Germany had taken all of Eastern Europe. Italy was her ally. Northern France had been occupied, had fallen to Hitler. Southern France, administered from the town of Vichy by Marshal Pétain, the so-called collaborationist France. By the way, the people of France tried Pétain as a war criminal, as a traitor to France when the war was over. That was a sad thing for them to do. Pétain was an important general of the French in World War I. And he was an old man, and he was a symbol of French honor. And yet he agreed to be the puppet administrator of collaborationist Vichy France for Hitler, because the people would accept him as a Frenchman better than a German puppet whom Hitler sent to administer them. This was not strategically important to Hitler because his ally was here, because Franco was here, and Franco was neutral, and the concern for Germany was Britain across the Channel. Now, out of fear of giving Stalin a free hand in Eastern Europe when the war is over, Churchill insisted that the counter-invasion come from the south. For the same reason, Stalin insisted that the counter-invasion come from the west through France. He did not want the strong United States and British power to be present in Eastern Europe when the war was over. The deciding vote was cast by Mr. Roosevelt. For whatever reason, and we cannot define it, Roosevelt sided with Stalin against Churchill. All logic would have suggested that Roosevelt and Churchill had more agreement with each other than either with Stalin. But the fact that Roosevelt cast the deciding vote determined that the counter-invasion would in fact come from the West, and it did in fact come from Normandy, the Normandy invasion in June of 1944. That's the significance of the Tehran Conference. It determined where this counterattack would come, and it created in its result the so-called Eastern Bloc. Those portions of Eastern Europe which had been conquered by Germany during the war became the Russian satellite system. They had been bordered in yellow. Now they are horizontally hatched in red as extensions of the Red Menace. This is Eastern Europe. This is the Iron Curtain that Churchill talked about in his speech in Fulton, Missouri. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended. And he listed all the great capitals in that speech of Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Poland, Berlin, East Germany, Prague, Czechoslovakia, Budapest, Hungary, Belgrade, Yugoslavia, Bucharest, Romania, Sofia, Bulgaria. All of these great medieval cities were now behind the Iron Curtain. All of them were now established as so-called People's Democratic Republics. the People's Democratic Republic of Bulgaria, of Romania, of Yugoslavia, and so forth. But with the exception of Yugoslavia, they were puppet states of Russia. By the way, this means that in the United Nations organization, established later in 1945, although each member nation has one vote, Russia had about a dozen votes because these puppet governments of Eastern Europe, the satellites of Russia, voted as they were told to do by Moscow. The United States had one vote. Russia, for all practical purposes, had a dozen votes. This was significant. Tehran produced this colonization of Eastern Europe by Russia after the war, because it gave Russia a free hand in the East. Now, hindsight makes wise men of us all. Yes, that's true. And the historian is not a prophet, and we don't deal with what might have been. But without that decision, what might have been the post-war world, we are tempted to wonder. Then, the next significant meeting is in February of 1945, the conference at Yalta. Yalta. Yalta is the Russian playground. Yalta is the Russian resort. Beaches. It is the Riviera of France. It is Russia's Riviera, Yalta, the Crimean Peninsula, the Crimea, Crimean War, 1854. This is a peninsula, and on it is the city of Yalta, where in the sunny clime in the Black Sea, Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin met for the last time, though there was to be another significant meeting. At this meeting, a number of decisions were made. Your book called it a remarkable success for Russian diplomacy. Stalin effectively twisted the arms of both Churchill and Roosevelt and got what Stalin wanted when the war was over. It was agreed at Yalta, and not all the agreements were known immediately. Some of them were not published until the death of all three, and the third to die was Stalin in 1963. It was in the 1960s before we knew all that had gone on at Yalta. What we did know was that Russia agreed to enter the war against Japan 3 months after the fall of Germany. And that meant that Russia did not go to war with Japan until August, the very month in which the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan. And yet Russia wanted a piece of the action of territory from Japan, though she had contributed virtually nothing toward the defeat of Japan. Interesting that Russia was not at war with Japan, although the Allied powers were. And you remember at Tehran, when Stalin wanted a second front, and Stalin was saying, "We've been bleeding and dying, we Russians, and while you Westerners have merely been taking bombs from the air." Churchill reminded him that he had started the war fighting on the wrong side. Stalin had started the war fighting, and he had even given Hitler the green light for the invasion of Poland by promising not to enter the war, made it possible for Hitler to conquer France in the West, and for Hitler to march into Paris and march under the Arc de Triomphe, the Napoleonic symbol of Napoleon's greatness, and virtually say by his presence that a greater than Napoleon is here. Napoleon thought it a great triumph to conquer Paris, the fashion center of Europe. He was amazed that there were not crowds out to hail his coming, and with good reason. At Yalta, then, and also, Russia was given a free hand in Eastern Europe by agreement at Yalta. Stalin promised that elections would be held in each of these Eastern European countries so that the people could decide what governments they wished. This proved to be conveniently forgotten by Stalin. Elections were held, but they were held under the point of the gun, as it were, and in every case, the Communist Party won the greatest number of seats. And in subsequent elections, only communist candidates were permitted to run. So it did not matter whom you voted for, Communist Party candidate A or Communist Party candidate B, the communists always won. But the facade, the appearance of elections, was made. The only way you could express dissent with the communist regime was refusal to vote. In so-called communist governments moving toward communism, there are extremely high percentages of popular participation in every election. If we in the United States get 65% of the electorate voting in a presidential election, we think we have a high degree of popular participation. In communist governments, they had 95, 97, 98, 99% of the voters voting. Because that was the only way you could express opposition to the party, was refusal to vote. If you voted, you voted for a Communist Party candidate. Now, when you go to the polls and cast your vote in this country, you show your voting certificate, and then your name is checked off on the list of registered voters. That's so you cannot come back in the afternoon and vote again. The checking off of who votes was a way of discovering who was not voting, and in the communist regime, who was not voting was a subtle way of opposing the regime. And therefore, the government became aware of who was not a fellow traveler, a supporter of the regime. Therefore, high percentage of voting participation. It was also very important at Yalta that already plans were being laid for the establishment of a peacekeeping organization when the war was over. And it was agreed at Yalta that the big powers, the superpowers, who became the permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations Organization. The United Nations organization is composed primarily of three major bodies. One is the Security Council. The second is the Assembly, the General Assembly. And third is the Secretariat, the third being merely the civil service, the clerical organization who carry out the functions determined by the decisions of the General Assembly and the Security Council. These were slight modifications from the composition of the League of Nations, which had a council and an assembly and a secretariat. With the UN, it's the Security Council, the General Assembly, and the secretariat. All right. On the Security Council, which is always prepared to meet as the steering committee whenever an issue comes up, though the General Assembly meets at regular intervals, but not always, the Security Council was composed of five permanent members, the big powers. They were defined eventually as the United States, Great Britain, France, Russia, and China. This is 1945. This is before the fall of China to the communists. Mao Zedong is still in civil war against Chiang Kai-shek. The nationalist Chinese are still China. They have not yet fled to Taiwan, where they have remained since. And the United States was supporting, although weakly, Chiang Kai-shek and Nationalist China. So at least three of these five powers were democratic republics. China was questionable, a military dictatorship, but not a communist dictatorship yet. And of course, Russia was the oddball, a totalitarian one-party dictatorship, but necessarily allied, because it was concluded at Yalta that unless the big powers worked in unison, there could be no teeth to the United Nations organization. And the problem with the League of Nations had been that it had no power to enforce its decisions. So a police power, the power to establish an army composed of contributing forces of member nations to implement or enforce decisions by the Security Council was considered essential if the UN was going to work. And yet it was considered necessary that the big powers act in unison. So the veto power was given at Yalta months before the organization was created. The veto power was given to each member, each permanent member on the Security Council, our rotating members as well, drawn from the general membership over 100 nations in the General Assembly. And they come and go. But among the big powers, there has to be unanimity. This is the reason you read in today's lesson that after Stalin had called in the head of the communists in North Vietnam and authorized him to invade South Korea in 1950 and to go south of the 38th parallel into South Korea. He, Stalin, then instructed his representative in New York at the meeting of the Security Council to walk out of the Security Council when the issue was being discussed, what to do as a result of the North Korean invasion of South Korea. It was an invasion that Stalin had sponsored, organized, engineered, and now he could not vote against it, obviously, and thus veto it and forbid any United Nations response. So he opted to have his man walk out, so the Russians abstained from non-participation. In the now 51 years since the creation of the United Nations organization, Russia has used the veto power more than 100 times in the Security Council to obstruct action by the United Nations organization. The United Nations and the United States in the same 50 years has used the veto power fewer than 10 times. And it's not difficult to answer the question, who has been responsible for the practical impotence of the United Nations organization, except when it suits Russia's purpose. That's important for the post-war world. A final meeting was held. Although you remember seeing the photograph of these three at Yalta, Roosevelt was a sick man. He was to be dead within 2 months. Nobody knew that then, but he looks like a dying man in the Yalta photographs. He dies in April in Warm Springs, Georgia, his southern White House, under rather obscure circumstances, presumably of natural causes. There is some question about that, but I can't go into it. And there is succeeding him immediately Harry Truman. Harry Truman, foul-mouthed but rather strong, backboned, not a typical politician, though a product of the Pendergast machine in Missouri, former haberdasher, clothing retailer, and thrust into sudden prominence. to suggest, men and women, what the role of the vice presidency was 50 years ago compared to what it has become in more recent times, we learn that Harry Truman did not even know when he became president of the existence of the Manhattan Project for the development of the atomic bomb. He was vice president of the United States, which has been called one of the useless jobs in America. Now a greater role has been given by many more recent presidents to their vice president. And he's not left out of the loop, in effect, as vice presidents had been. Now, Mr. Truman inherited the atomic bomb. He had not even known of its existence before then. Remember, both Stalin and Hitler had had men working on an atomic bomb project. But the Stalinists lacked the expertise, and the Nazis lacked the motivation at this point. Hitler did not give it high priority. They were developing some rocket bombs that could fly over the Channel into Britain, and they were well along in their rocketry. The Germans. But you remember that a good number of the German scientists defected and came to the United States and became important contributors to the American space program eventually, as they had been to the Manhattan Project for the development of the atomic bomb. Now, a final meeting brought together an unlikely group who had never met before. For the first time, at Potsdam, Germany, in July of 1945. Now, between February, Yalta, and July, Potsdam is in Germany, because between Yalta and Potsdam, Germany had capitulated May 8th, 1945. So 2 months after Yalta, Germany falls. 2 months after the fall of Germany, the meeting at Potsdam, to declare to the world a warning addressed primarily to Japan to surrender or else. Now, surrender was not in Japan's vocabulary. You must understand this. And part of the history of Japanese culture was that betrayal, surrender, was violation of ancestry. It was not possible. It was loss of face. They were forbidden. The Americans took very few prisoners in the Japanese islands campaigns. They preferred to die rather than surrender. And in the late months of the war, the kamikaze pilots, suicide pilots, if they did not have enough gasoline to fly their planes back to their bases or to their carriers, they, loaded with bombs, would aim them at the smokestacks of Allied battleships and blow up the battleships and themselves in a final act for the fatherland. And against this kind of thing, the bombings of the Japanese mainland were producing firestorms, because of the comparatively flimsy construction materials with which Japanese houses were then made, and blocks were destroyed, whole portions of cities, by conventional incendiary bombs. The Japanese would not surrender. And the threat was, surrender or you will feel the results of a weapon which makes all former war pale into insignificance by comparison. And such threats were not explained and understood by very few people in the world. And the argument is that more people's lives were saved on both sides in the war by the use of the atomic bomb than by the failure to use it. If you add up all the people whose lives were immediately lost, those who were burned, maimed, sterilized, unborn generations, if you add them all up, compared with the estimates of casualties on both the American and the Japanese sides, based on the examples of the islands of the Pacific, which were bloody battles with tens of thousands of casualties on both sides and hundreds of prisoners at most. Now, such a statement cannot be proved because it was not allowed to be proved. So it's an argument from speculation, but history is not dealing with what might have been, but with what was. I find it very instructive that the bomb at Hiroshima and at Nagasaki, though nothing but firecrackers by compared with the present existence of hydrogen bombs and cobalt bombs, which makes those atomic bombs seem like firecrackers, although those atomic bombs made the conventional 2,000-pound bombs that were used over Germany and over England seem like firecrackers, these were exponential, geometrically more destructive bombs. The use of these two bombs, I say, has guaranteed that now for more than 50 years, in all the wars that have been fought in the world in these 50 years, and there are a lot of them, never again has one atomic weapon been used. It may have been that the use of the bomb was the most effective deterrent to its ever being used again. Now, the assumption of mutual destruction, see, that nobody can use the bomb without its being used against them, and the escalation will soon destroy the human race from off the earth, as if that were possible. As if God would permit men to do what he has determined to do in his own time. See? No dumb fool is going to press the button and destroy the universe, or the earth, or all living things on it. And if he does, who will be left to criticize him? Who cares? See? We'll have to start the evolutionary process all over again. Yeah, I speak as a fool, and so do they. Yeah. But the deterrent effect of its use may have been wars fought in Korea, in Israel, in Africa, in Kampuchea, in Cambodia, in Vietnam, all over the world, today in Liberia, and everywhere else. There has never been the hint of a use of an atomic weapon. Because everybody knows that anybody who uses it, it'll be used against them. This may have saved more lives than it cost. Good day.